This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You had last year, under the Trump administration, there was released the latest National Climate Assessment Report for the U.S. And this is a report by top scientists from 13 federal agencies. And the report was crystal clear. Climate change is happening now. It's affecting all of our sectors, all of our regions, all our states, and it is going to be worse over time. And we need to do something about it. So you have 13 federal agencies, the top scientists saying that they are not in denial.
For years, climate denialists put forth the narrative that it would cripple the U.S. economy to sign on to international climate agreements like the Kyoto Protocol. They said that other major carbon-emitting countries like India and China needed to be on board in order for the U.S. to join. It's clear now, however, that this narrative was always just a smokescreen. The Trump administration is pulling the U.S. out of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which notably does include India and China, and is an historic accord representing more than 87% of global greenhouse gas emitters. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Helen Mountford, the Vice President for Climate and Economics at the World Resource Institute. She breaks down what the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement means. We look at when this withdrawal would actually go into effect, examine some Trumpian lies about the agreement itself, and discuss the impact it will have on the U.S. and the planet moving forward. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Helen Mountford. She's the Vice President for Climate and Economics at the World Resource Institute. Helen, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
What is the World Resource Institute for our listeners?
The World Resource Institute is a think tank, a global think tank and do tank, working at the interface on how we can actually achieve better environmental outcomes that are better for society and people as well. We work in over 50 countries around the world and have international offices in 11 major economies.
So the news this week that we wanted to discuss was that the Trump administration is going forward with its withdrawal of the Paris Climate Agreement. Why don't you first rehash what the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement is and what this withdrawal from the U.S. means?
Absolutely. So the 2015 Paris Agreement was an incredible landmark where almost 200 countries around the world came together, recognized the global challenge we face on climate change. That climate change is here. It's happening now. It's human induced. And that we can actually tackle it globally together. But all countries need to play their part. So the agreement was countries coming together, recognizing this, and each of those countries submitting what it would be able to do itself to actually tackle the climate agenda in terms of reducing emissions, in terms of providing finance, in terms of adapting to a changing climate. So it's really a historic moment where countries came together, saw this challenge, and agreed to tackle it together.
What is the excuse that the Trump administration has given the world for pulling out of this historic agreement besides that Donald Trump doesn't like Barack Obama?
I think the reasoning that we hear from the administration is that the Paris Agreement was not necessarily in the U.S. interest, or it's going to harm the U.S. economy, U.S. employment, etc. The reality is what we're seeing is it's a very, very different story. Pulling out of the Paris Agreement is going to be damaging for the U.S. It's going to hurt the competitiveness of our economy. We have other countries that are now moving ahead and seizing really the new growth story, the new economic story of the future, moving forward on renewable energy and electric vehicles, on better transport, more efficient infrastructure. And the U.S. is the one who's going to be slipping behind. That's where the jobs are. That's where the new economic opportunities are. That's where industry is moving. And we see that. We see businesses and investors are wanting to move forward, and they are aligned often with the Paris Agreement. So unfortunately, the U.S. is the one who's going to be very much left behind if it pulls out of the Paris Agreement.
So let's go through some of the dubious claims that President Trump threw out on June 1st, 2018, when he announced that the U.S. would be withdrawing from the Paris Agreement on climate change. First, he said renegotiation is possible, but that's not true, is it?
Well, in fact, every country came forward and indicated what they, as a country, would be contributing towards moving to a lower emission and climate safe society. So each country announced their own plans and ambitions. Next year, in 2020, all countries are asked to come back again to confirm these or to indicate what more they will do, having had 5 years in between to learn more about the world and reality. So each country comes forward with its own plans. It also then has the opportunity to revise and update these every 5 years. So in terms of the individual country actions, these are nominated by the country themselves. Beyond that, there is a broader international agreement in the Paris Agreement about where we want to go as a world. And that is not open for renegotiation. There's elements of that that are still being settled. Some of the elements of the Paris rulebook on how international markets for carbon emissions might work, for example, and what are the timelines for reporting or for review, these things are still being settled and negotiated amongst countries. But in terms of what an individual country signs up to, that's up to them themselves.
And I don't know the intermachinations, the evolution of this agreement and how countries would continue to renegotiate. But I would imagine that being a signator to the treaty itself would increase communication and increase likelihood that there could be productive quote-unquote renegotiations, or barometers can be shifted and goalposts changed accordingly. But wouldn't it be a lot more powerful if the U.S. was a signatory to the agreement?
Absolutely. At the moment, if the U.S. does indicate that they're going to be pulling out, the first opportunity they can do so is on November 4th, 2019, and that enters into force and becomes active a year later. So in early November 2020 is when that would take place. The U.S. until that time is still welcome, of course, in the negotiations and the discussions. But to be frank, even since last year, when Trump first announced to the U.S. that he planned to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. Even since then, the extent to which other countries are going to view U.S. interventions with the same amount of respect and listen to their views has gone down. So that will continue to go down. U.S. will still be at the table initially, but knowing that they're exiting means that their voice will not be as powerful as it otherwise would be. So staying in the agreement, staying in the Paris Agreement, really would give the U.S. Much more of a voice and ability to discuss and influence others in these negotiations.
So, Helen, I'm a little confused by some of the dissonance I've heard from the Trump administration on the Paris Agreement, and maybe you can kind of help me understand it better. The president said that the U.S. intends to begin negotiations to re-enter the Paris Agreement while saying the U.S. will cease all implementation of the Paris Agreement. But what I've read is that the U.S. remains a party to the Paris Agreement until at least November 2020, and that the U.S. can't re-enter the Paris Agreement until after it is legally withdrawn from the Paris Agreement, and the earliest withdrawal that can take place is in November of 2020. So those things seem to not connect in my mind. What am I missing?
So indeed, the way the Paris Agreement has been set up means that the first moment when the U.S. can officially withdraw, can indicate its intention to officially withdraw, is actually on November 4th, 2019. That's the first moment when they can send a letter to the Secretariat of the UN Climate Convention and say the U.S. would like to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. Once they have sent that letter, it takes a year to become active. So the U.S. would actually then officially withdraw in early November 2020. At the moment, it's just sending that official signaling that it intends to withdraw, and then it would actually withdraw and step out from November 2020.
So let's say Donald Trump is impeached or isn't reelected. The incoming president doesn't have a beef with the Paris Agreement, wants to re-enter the U.S. How soon after November 2020 can the U.S. re-enter the Paris Agreement if, in fact, the Trump administration, as expected, withdraws this week?
Very quickly, a new president or the current president can signal shortly after leaving that they intend to re-enter, and then that happens fairly quickly. It's quite easy to re-enter. It's a longer process to actually exit having done so.
So that's good news. What will the withdrawal mean for America's role in these upcoming UN climate negotiations, like the G7, which the U.S. is hosting next year?
Well, the U.S. is hosting the G7 next year. There's also the G20 discussions with the U.S. that engages in. Traditionally, these have both, in recent years, have had a focus on climate change and climate action by those groups of countries. The U.S. has already indicated that they're not planning that climate change would be a priority on those negotiations. What we're seeing increasingly in other countries is a recognition of how closely tied climate action and addressing climate change is to economic growth and development priorities. So the main focus of those discussions is really about the economy in the countries and how to help ensure the global economy is robust and moving forward. And I think what we're seeing is that more and more countries around the world recognize that you cannot discuss that usefully without actually also bringing in climate change. That is part and parcel. So we'd expect there will be other countries that will push back on the U.S. on those.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Helen Mountfort. She's a vice president for climate and economics at the World Resource Institute. So, Helen, how much impact can states make in the face of this withdrawal announcement? For example, I know California has pretty bold climate standards and initiatives in place. This is the world's fifth largest economy by some measure. How do the states affect how we should view the U.S.'s withdrawal of the Paris Agreement?
So these are, in fact, if you actually take the 70% of the U.S. GDP that is in one of these state cities, corporations or universities that said they're still in the Paris Agreement, still trying to achieve the Paris goals. If you take that 70% of U.S. GDP, that would actually be the equivalent of the world's second largest economy, second only to the U.S. itself. So it's a significant amount of the economy that is really dedicated towards still achieving the Paris goals. And we see this play out in various different ways. In the U.S. at the moment, we've got something like 33 of our states which are actually growing their economies while also reducing their emissions, their greenhouse gas emissions. We have 29 states that have renewable portfolio standards, so targets on renewable energy. We have 26 states with energy efficiency standards, in most cases saving money. You know, for each dollar invested in energy efficiency, we often save something like $2 to $5. Similarly, we have now 9 states that have committed to 100% clean energy legislation. So we've got a lot of action that's going on in the states, in the cities, and in corporations and investors in universities that's really moving us towards a low carbon economy. This is fantastic. And to some extent, I mean, I think we can actually say they actually stepped up in the last couple of years because the federal government was signaling its intention to pull out of the Paris Agreement. So we've probably seen even more action at the subnational level in the U.S. than we would have expected had that not happened. At the same time, as we go forward, maintaining this level of commitment and momentum is going to become harder and more challenging if they don't have federal re-engagement. At the federal level, having strong signals that go across states, across cities, and which clearly show the direction of travel, what the commitments are, how to actually align the policy frameworks, those are things that we hear from the corporate sector they really, really want to see. That's why many businesses and corporations are turning to the administration and saying, we want you to stay in the Paris Agreement. We want you to send clear signals in terms of climate policies. And many are starting to say, and we want carbon pricing. Carbon pricing gives them a very strong, clear market signal of where to invest, how to shift what they're doing, their investments, and how to look for the cheapest opportunities to actually reduce emissions. So we see a strong call from the corporates for carbon pricing in particular.
So, Helen, let's go into the benefits of the Paris Agreement. How do you and your colleagues view this historic agreement, and how would it affect America if we had stayed in it? This is a net positive for us, not just in terms of clean air and clean water, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we've seen is even since the Paris Agreement was signed 4 years ago, the costs of some of the technologies that we're talking about have continued to like plummet. Solar panels, wind power, their costs have fallen so quickly and so dramatically that they're now not only outcompeting coal in most regions of the world, they're increasingly cheaper than maintaining existing coal. So not even just new coal, but then maintaining new coal, it's cheaper to bring down the coal power and to replace it with renewables. Similarly, we're starting to see in many countries around the world that they're outcompeting natural gas. So we actually now have this, not only do we have the technologies and the solutions we need to actually put this in place, they're increasingly cheaper and cheaper than the status quo technologies. So we are starting to see, because of that, a massive shift in the markets and the investments. And in fact, in most cases, what we're finding is policies are chasing to catch up to where the markets have shifted. Given all this, we did do an assessment as part of the new climate economy last year, looked at what are the opportunities to move to a low carbon economy around the world, and what would this cost us, what sort of investments would be needed, but what benefits would this bring? And the thing that we found was that it quite incredibly, you would get benefits amounting to something like $26 trillion in increased GDP, net increase in GDP by 2030 globally by moving to a low-carbon economy, given the opportunities we have out there now. In addition to that, you would get new jobs. We would have something like 65 million low-carbon jobs in 2030 alone. That's equivalent to the current total jobs in Egypt and the UK combined, so quite important there. And we would also have quite a benefit in terms of reduced health impacts, something like 700,000 avoided deaths from air pollution in 2030 alone. So there's definitely some strong benefits there, which we're missing out of if we're not part of this transition and in the front lines.
Can you explain a little more in detail how the researchers come up with these estimated job numbers? Just take one country, for example, it doesn't have to be the U.S., and say how entering this agreement will help create jobs. Break that down if you can.
Let me give you a couple of examples in terms of what that means. I mean, already today, actually, in the U.S., we have something like 3.4 million Americans who are employed in the clean energy sector, right? At the moment, we have two times more solar energy jobs in the U.S. than coal jobs. And we're having increasingly less in the coal sector, not because of government policy, but because we're seeing the markets have shifted. It's not the cheapest option. So states are increasingly investing in clean energy just because it's cheaper. And often, in many cases, those jobs, you end up getting more jobs per megawatt of energy produced, right? they tend to require more to actually develop the resources to put them in place. And then you get a lot more in terms of energy efficiency or servicing or maintenance. So it's actually a job creator, a net job creator. Now, one of the things we absolutely have to manage and manage much better than we're doing right now is the transition for the workers in the communities in some of those sectors, which are actually starting to shrink, right? The coal sector, some of the heavy industry sectors. We need to manage that well to ensure a just transition for those workers, for those communities, working together with the trade unions, with the workers themselves, with the businesses locally, with the community colleges, to look at how to diversify the economy in those regions, how to generate new types of employment and do the training needed to shift workers, and how in some cases to work out early retirement packages. But the reality is those shifts are happening. We're seeing those shifts happening because of the market forces. And it's the duty of the government. And what we need from them is to help actually manage those transitions well, rather than trying to resist them and pretend they're not happening.
And if the U.S. is not part of the Paris Agreement, what is the downside in terms of breaking that promise that we're talking about in terms of jobs and clean air and greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, I mean, what we're seeing is that other countries are really taking the lead now. It used to be that the U.S. and China were sort of neck and neck for a while in terms of development of solar technologies. But now China is far, far ahead of the U.S. Similarly on electric vehicles, electric buses, something like 99% of the electric buses in the world today are all in China. It sort of leapt ahead and has taken on that competitive advantage. So the U.S. is already in a position of playing catch up. The more that we slip behind, the more we move away from a strong federal policy on climate change, the further we're going to be off track from where the new economy is going. I mean, you mentioned there's also real, not just jobs, not just industry and competitiveness, but also real impacts for individuals as well. And there was a report out last week, which found that the slip in air pollution since 2016, PM 2.5, particulate matter 2.5, has actually increased in the U.S. after having gone down for quite a few years. That air pollutant started to increase again since 2016. And in 2018, there was something like 9,700 additional premature deaths in the U.S. alone, just because of the increase in that air pollutant. So locking ourselves into polluting technologies, fossil fuel burning, vehicles that are based on gasoline, these are the ways that we're continuing to actually lead to real health costs for individuals, for Americans, and premature deaths.
Save the world.
Save the world.
You've got to save the world.
Save the world.
All the boys and girls
from around the world.
You've got to save the world.
Save the
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Helen Mountford. She's the Vice President for Climate and Economics at the World Resource Institute. So, Helen, what are climate experts hearing about how other countries may react to the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Agreement? Is this business as usual? Are they just rolling their eyes? Or does this have significant direct impact on how leaders will proceed in implementing their country's end of the bargain?
I'd say it's a combination of both, right? I mean, you do certainly have a number of countries. People are very aware that Trump has indicated before his intention of pulling out of the Paris Agreement. And what we saw when that happened is not just the U.S. states and cities and businesses stepping up action, but actually a number of other countries really stepped up action and said, well, if we don't have the U.S. leadership anymore, the rest of us actually need to take even more of a role. So you had a number who stepped up action, and they'll probably be some who will still continue to do so. But to be frank, in countries where there is an open debate and discussion about how much they should do on climate action, with the U.S. pulling away, what you increasingly have is everyone turning around and saying, well, the U.S. isn't doing much. Should we do quite as much, or should we be pushing them to step back in and the U.S. to take on more action? When you look historically at the emissions that have been released into the atmosphere over time, it is absolutely clear the U.S. is responsible for by far the majority of global emissions. So for other countries, when they look at the U.S. stepping back, that really does cause them some concern, some great concern, and some questions about equity. If the U.S. has been responsible for the majority of emissions, how come the U.S. is getting away with not actually taking that on and reducing them at a federal level?
Yes, I mean, it seems pretty ironic that the U.S. is the greatest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions, and yet we're also the only country that has a robust climate-denying movement afoot that has kind of landed us here in this position where we're a real rogue nation. I mean, even President Trump's favorite ally, Russia, is a signatory to the agreement. It's kind of impossible to wrap your head around the fact that we are here, isn't it?
It is. It is bizarre, and you're absolutely right. When we look around the world, there is no country and no major political party in any country other than here in the U.S. which actually puts forward a position of climate denial. The rest of the world, it's very clear to everyone that the science is clear. Climate change is happening. Our actions are contributing to climate change, and we need to do something about it to actually stop that. What the debate is in other countries is how much we do and when and who does what first and how do you actually finance it. Those are the questions you have in other countries. You don't have questions about whether climate change is happening or whether it's caused by human-induced actions. Those are not under question. Interestingly, I would say in the U.S. even, under the current administration, when you look at the scientists in the U.S. government agencies, I don't think they believe in climate denialism either. You had last year, under the Trump administration, there was released the latest National Climate Assessment Report for the U.S., and this is a report by top scientists from 13 federal agencies, and the report was crystal clear. Climate change is happening now, it's affecting all of our sectors, all of our regions, all our states, and it is going to be worse over time, and we need to do something about it. So you have 13 federal agencies, the top scientists saying that they are not in denial.
Helen Mountford is the Vice President for Climate and Economics at the World Resource Institute. Helen, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It was great to talk to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Police, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and Tenacious D.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.